So I apparently forgot to say something at intermission, and I'm just told I have to say it now because it sets up the third of my career. So what I normally say during an intermission is that that's your chance to try to get laid. So, there you go. I just said it. Okay. Number
no
one. Our first reader, Perry. Perry here. There he is.
Yeah.
Thanks to our featured folks, you know, for their cyberness, their pseudomorphism, doing it in the libraries of Ratchet, whatever, you know, Ulysses, and high school stuff. So, I'll stick to the 5-minute rule. I got 2 minutes to share with you. Thank you very much. Some history. When I was a dog, I was a very successful dog. A stealthy dog. I learned to bury my bone. No one would find me. Or so. When I was a bird, I was a graceful bird. I could swoop and soar. I wore a vibrant plume and my feathers were widely sought. When I was a fish, I could breathe underwater. So I swallowed whole all the ocean had to offer, and sirens shared my bed. When I was a tree with roots deep in soil and my limbs spread wide against the sky, my hollows sheltered precious life, so I never slept at night. When I was a star, I knew no bounds, and I had no need for faith or hope until I fell to earth. Now, I'm just another dog barking at night. I'm just another bird feathered in my nest. I am just a fish, and there are so many in the sea, and I can't quite decide if I'm a forest or a tree. This is called One in My Hand. I wake in the middle of the night, one hand on my heart, the other's on my cock. There is something between my heart and my cock. My stomach. My stomach is alive. It prevents me from getting my heart and my cock together. Stomach and all its interferences, all its desire for attention, blocking the other two from getting together. It's hungry, but not for food. It's just that hungry ghost. It wants wine. That other trickster that acts as if it will be alluring, only to reveal itself to be another hindrance. It's too big. A big stomach is not attractive. Heart and cock are attractive, and stomach is envious of them both for their true attractive part. So stomach interferes. Yes, it interferes with stomach. Eat and feel full of lies, as if fullness is a substitute for fulfillment. Drink and be merry at lies, as if the high spirits of too much wine would open unseen doors. It's just another trick. My heart and cock want to come together on a project. They always have. It's the persistent, recurring dream. And that's why their stomach gets involved. He comes along and says, I see you two have a hunger. That's something I know all about. Here, let me help you with that. Stomach, this is like any savvy trickster can be a very convincing salesman. So heart and cock overlook the fine print. Their hunger to unite on the vision they see, the project they desire, let them be tricked by stomach. Stomach tells lies like, put down your tools and go get me a drink. Or, don't go to yoga, feed me instead. Stomach says, I may be hanging over your belt, scaring off otherwise suitable mates, but trust me, I will always be here for you in the morning when you wake up. Will she? I hate stomach for this manipulation. I wake up in the middle of the night, one hand on my cock, the other on my heart. The two want to come together. I imagine some yogic movement through which the two might actually touch, but I don't see a logical possibility, so I begin to examine the metaphor. My heart and cock want to come together. Now that sounds like true love. They both had their turn at bat before, but now they desire to play on the same team. These hands, they are what bring the two together. Not the stomach, not the hunger, the hands. The doing, the making, the touching, the feeling, the hands that form and shape, the hands that take apart and put back together, the hands that hold, the hands through which all things pass. The hands are the vehicles of expression that manifest the spirit inside, the articulators of imagination, the instruments of the divine. Just imagine what these hands might do for us.
Yeah!
Larry.
Hi, my name is Larry Crist. I'm here, and thanks for sticking around. This is, I want to plug this. I just got my contributor's copy, Minnetonka Review, out of Minnesota. And I want to read thank you. Some Minnesota people here. Okay, I'm very proud of this poem in particular because this poem I wrote about 15 years ago. And I always liked this poem. I've never changed a word of it. And I finally got the fucker published. And it's well researched. So this is like a nonfiction kind of poem. This is called
Wikipedia.
This is called, and actually this cost me about four or five books. I wrote this before Wikipedia. So this is called John Dillinger Lives. John Dillinger Lives. Unlike Elvis, unlike J. Edgar, unlike little Melvin Purvis, who watched that night outside the Biograph, where Manhattan melodrama with Clark Gable played, waiting for J.D. to exit arm in arm with the lady in red, Anna Sage, who was supposed to set him up, but maybe she was setting up the FBI. Maybe J. Edgar was setting up the American people. Gee, man, it wouldn't have been the first time, would it? Whomever they shot outside that theater and photographed on the slab had brown eyes. Dillinger's were blue. The FBI explained the altered physiognomy had occurred through plastic surgery, but none of J.D.'s documented scars were on the cadaver, who was shorter and heavier and had a rheumatic heart condition, which would have prevented him from being in the Navy or playing minor league baseball or leaping over bank counters. Only the prince, as provided by the FBI, lined up. Only 4 months before this staged execution, J.D. escaped maximum security using a bar of soap carved to look like a pistol. J. Edgar's lace panties were in a wad. Do you suppose, just maybe, crime did pay, and the J.D., the most successful bank robber of all time, got away just like he said he would? Caught up with Butch and Sundance, leaving D.B. Cooper somewhere to follow. And if so, whose massive member is that anyway in that jar of formaldehyde that lives in the basement of the Smithsonian that J. Edgar used to like to dress up for, wearing stockings and heels and a modest veil so he wouldn't look like a common whore? And he spent the evenings with those nights Clyde was out of town, or the six or seven presidents who employed him, who, as time went by, were less apt to ask, J. Edgar, what have you done for us lately? Mardi Gras just came and went. It was late this year, and this is a Mardi Gras poem I wrote a couple of years ago when I was there. This is called Fat Tuesday, because I couldn't think of what else to call it. So. Fat Tuesday. The streets were filthy with beads, piss, beer, puke. A week's worth of debauchery settled in a single day with drunks of every race, class, nationality, unified, surrendering and slumming with the bottle, buttloads of bottles, cans, cups, and those ubiquitous bright green plastic grenades called the Hurricane. Manufactured husks and human husks filled the street, littered the sidewalks. A plump girl with a tight purple dress and heels ran past us, pursued by a greasy young man, lanky, dark, unctuous, a mustache, looked like he pumped gas for a living. She was blonde, made up, pissed off, stopped beside the building before us. She had been crying. He grabbed her, tried to kiss her. She clocked him. They fell back into a doorway of a business not open. A half block later, she ran by again, and again he followed, her ass straining through that purple dress, stretched like a second skin, her fleshy shoulders heavy with anger, heaving with emotion. He grabbed her. She swung at him. He blocked this, held her wrist. She sobbed into the crook of his neck. He stroked her curly, dyed blonde hair. Her eyes bled all over him. The streets were full of staggering, beaded people, some costumed in masks, growing scarier in the dark, trying to be with it, have a good time, score, or a good time gone bad, trying to get out of it, get loose, stay tight, not fall, nor get beamed by beads from above. Or in our case, rear-ended from behind, as again she raced by, and again he caught up, shook her like you should never shake a baby. She broke his hold, her metal fists spread like flowers. Her painted nails clutched the air. His were extended, stained, pleading. It looked like the end of something or a brand new war-torn beginning. Not a comedy, that's for sure. Last tango in French Quarter. I could already hear the music, minor keys, somber bass, tortured brass. She passed us again, carrying her heels, her fish-meat feet black from the street. Everything pulling within that tight hemline, that big, round, purple ass moving up the street like a planet, orbiting weirdly round our gravity. They formed a single silhouette, he into her and she into him, swallowed by the night. Just another couple on Fat Tuesday, too much something, maybe one another, maybe something else, full of rage, hurt, hormones, youth, liquor, you name it, these kids had it all. Oh, to be in love like that again. Thank you. You're way too kind, or you're still drunk from Mardi Gras. And I'd like to close with this. I also had this published recently, or got my contributor copy, and I'm not going to read this because actually I've seen this around Willow Springs. It's out of Spokane, and there are a lot of good people here, and I'm honored to be in their ranks. But anyway, this is at LEFA and other places, so check this out. I got a poem in there, and I'd like to close with a short poem that will never get published anywhere. And I'm quite ashamed of, but I'm going to read it anyway. This is called Pop Dreams. In my dream, I'm kicking Justin Bieber's ass. I'd sooner dream I was fucking Angelina Jolie, but kicking Justin Bieber's ass is not without its joy. I'd smack him in his pretty upturned nose, send a left into those perfect pearly choppers. Of course, he's not grinning in my dream. He's in tears and flails his thin, girly arms protectively over his flouncy hair. Fans of his stand on the sidelines of my dreams, expressing their horror at what a prick I am. Yeah, I'd much rather be having that other dream, Angelina or that girl that tends bar at the Elysian. Why can't we pick our dreams? The unfairness of it irks me, and I pass this on to the teen throb solar plexus. I have nothing against young Bieber, aside from his overexposed face and his senseless saccharine pop rock sound. He's merely the it boy. Last year, this could have been Zac Efron, or generational pop eons ago, Bobby Sherman, who begat David Cassidy, who begat, well, who the fuck cares? Who the fuck cares, Justin? I holler, his fans and posse murmur, we do, we love Justin. I silenced it with another kick, a low one, as he's on the ground, and I'm not getting any younger, even in my dreams. God, what an asshole I am. I pause to watch as he spits out a couple of teeth. I quickly recover from this bout of self-reflection and kick him again, feeling his ribs give way against my foot. He'll have other problems later, but I'm his problem now. Yeah, I'd much rather be fucking Angelina Jolie, but this is what I get instead. Is it any reason why I'm bitter, Justin? I give him another. Take that, I scream in my dream. Both of us hoping one of us wakes up soon. Thank you. Woo!
Hello.
Thank you, Bob, for open mic and YouTube are making history. This is the first time in the last, I don't know, 2-3 years that the featured reader actually stayed for the open mic. So. And speaking of the crowd, some of you may have been here last time when I read my piece. Most of you haven't. So here is what you should know. It was very personal, sensitive and honest, extremely thoughtful. I took a huge risk, showed a tremendous amount of vulnerability, was very, very attentive, and kept eye contact throughout. And I still didn't get laid. So I went home and I couldn't sleep. I thought, what have I done? How could I do it? For 2.5 years or so, I worked so hard to build a reputation and I ruined it. No one will ever believe me that most of my poetry can be defined as coming from an no more, no less than an ever-holy, somewhat creepy, middle-aged man who's trying desperately to be funny. I turned from side to side until at around 5 a.m. I got up. I sat at the computer and I looked at the very first piece I wrote after many, many years of absence. It was after the Chipmunk poetry event I attended on Bamboo Shoots some 2.5 years ago. Many of you don't remember this piece, I wrote it here before. Nevertheless, it was some sort about the crush, about the neighbor, and tomato plants, and all this kind of stuff. And I rewrote it. Hopefully, I will regain my reputation. So, just so you know, all models are over the age of 18. The characters and events in this portrait are fictitious. There are no resemblance to actual events, though I fully wish they would. So I will tell the beginning and the end of the original piece. What's in between is a little different. And it's called Number 12, Big Ben is Ben. That was part of the show, I think you should be annoyed, because now comes the piece. It's called Number 12, Revised. And I will change my tone when I go back from the old piece to the somewhat new piece, and I hope you appreciate it. Yes, I have an accent and a fairly large nose. But usually, I do behave. Oh, hi. I'm the guy from apartment number 12. It was over a year ago when you first walked by my door. I don't suppose you would remember. I, on the other hand, almost fell on the floor. Whoa, is this my neighbor? Okay, here comes the new part. Enough politically correctness here. Shall we get some action here? Not sure what you might have heard, but I assure you, it's a proof. Really, I'm not such a nerd. Don't believe me. Here's the proof. It's been a while for both, my dear. This is it. There's no retreat. Let's just do it now, right here, while the car is parked down the street. So quit going up the stairs. Stand right there. I'm a bit too scared. I love your lovely panties. Now, may I get under your shirt? Turn around. Head to the railing. Stick it out. Good. Just like that. Ooh. I'd love to jump. You what? Did you say something more than? She said, oh my god, I don't know. Anyway, turn around. Head to the railing. Stick it out. good. Yeah, I did. Love to jump up on the phone. Relax, dear. I'm not into animal item. I call it while still standing, doggy style. Time for justice to be done. Are you ready to be served? Please stand a tiny bit more, huh? For good or bad, mine doesn't care. So glad we shared all of our masks. Yes, this is what it really takes. And if anybody asks, let's just say we lost our brakes. It's not our fault. Here comes the rain ending from the original part. I think by now I got the message and will not bug you anymore. So don't be afraid to walk by my door like you used to do before. Really, that's okay. I promise I'll pretend to look the other way. Thank you.
They sleep on the grass, green, and night they sleep. Our bathroom is split into stalls. Why are they here and sleep green on green? The sprinklers come on, then they're gone. I know I'm one of the young of this city. Here is a language. We eat chestnuts and buttered gnocchi. We wander through an abate setic, thinking it is Florentine. Narrow streets with lamps from shops and houses. We borrow from dust to stay young in the city. You are the Dan River. I am the Kinneret. The old immigration room at the top of the stairs at Ben Gurion is still. The room of immigration at old Ben Gurion at the top of the stairs is not. Ben Gurion is his house with his book and white hair. The kibbutz of Ben Gurion, the city of David, as well as the stars of David, the names of David are. And not are the kibbutzim who have folded. The young have climbed out to build kibbutzim. Dir Yassin is not, but Har Nof is. The keys they keep are, and there is no us.
Mostly know me as a poetess. I also write under a pen name of Tucker Max. And this is my volume. I hope it's served beer in hell. I hope you will enjoy it.
No.
This is from the chapter, She Won't Take No for an Answer. Occurred December 2002. Written March 2005. This always happens to me, and it pisses me off. If I dawdle and wait too long to approach a group of girls, invariably, the ugliest one calls me in the group. I have no idea why. One girl I know told me it was because I am attractive, but not great looking. So ugly girls think they have a chance with me. And she added that to people I don't know, I have an approachable air about me. What sweet irony. One night my friends and I were out drinking, and we were sitting next to a table of girls. One was pretty hot, one was fuckable, and the other was awful. One was a fetal alcohol case, no question. Something nasal bridge, thin upper lip, a short and smooth skin between the nose and upper lip, all the telltale signs. She looked sort of like she'd been hit in the face with a frying pan. Before we make our move, one of the girls comes over to talk to me. Do you want to guess which one? Well, it wouldn't be a story unless it was the bag of smashed assholes. Now would it? As my friends talked to the fuckable ones, I tried to make it clear to Panface that I was not into her. I told her the most absurd shit, things that I was sure would offend her so badly she wouldn't even want to look at me, much less fuck me. I will never date you. I won't call you. I probably won't even talk to you afterwards, unless it's to tell you to get out. I am going to cum in your hair. Do you know how hard it is to get cum out of hair? For real, if I come home with you, you will have to eat out my ass. And I haven't showered in 3 days. I will only want to fuck you from behind. And you can't look at me when I'm fucking you either. I might lose my heart on. I want you to wear a paper bag on your head, cut a hole for your mouth, and give me head with it on. No, seriously, I will probably just come on your back, then get dressed and leave, and I'll probably break some trinket of yours on my way out, just to show my disdain for you. Come on. Even a washed-up stripper shilling out her quarter tips at a topless truck stop would have told me to fuck off, whether she thought I was joking or not. And I was. Kinda. Some of that shit is just over the line. What girl would keep talking to a guy who said those things? I mean, honestly, I told the girl that I would only fuck her from behind because if she looked at me, I would lose my heart on. The girl had to have stopped at some point. Right? Nope. She got all googly-eyed and smitten and told me I was the funniest guy she'd ever met. Doesn't it always happen this way? I would have just ended it for real, but before I could, she discovered my weakness, an open tab. I couldn't finish my drink before she had two more in front of me. Of course, this feedback loop led to disaster. The constant stream of Red Bull and Goose made me more animated and sarcastic, which made her more into me, which allowed me to tolerate her more, which inspired her to lean into me and expose her cleavage, which caused me to comment on her nice breasts, which led to her massaging my crotch, which made me consider what she would be like in bed. To continue with this line of thought, I had to switch to doubles. Yeah, I fucked her. Thank you. Brian Eane. Thank you.
horrifying.
I see nuts.
You like it, Grant?
I spilled wine on my pants, and I don't even think you could see that I spilled wine on my pants. If you could see that I spilled wine on my pants, it'd be much more funny.
Can you do it?
I also spilled wine on my girlfriend's pants, and I spilled wine on a stranger's jacket.
Stay away from me!
And when the cup fell, it fell perfectly straight down.
Did it?
It was beautiful.
Oh, that's good that there was a symmetry to that.
It was gorgeous.
Whole ordeal, because it was embarrassing. Sorry? Maybe. Okay, I'm gonna read stuff now. It's unimportant what I'm going to read. No, it's really important. Start. Ah, Albert, come down, dummy, forget Gary's harassments. I just jogged, limped, made no negatively pensive questioning remarks. So, to undertake vicious belated inquiry. Your wounds are bleeding. Can dear old friends greet, huh, honey? Jesus, Jan, no, I don't like this, I don't want to read it. Nah, it's not good. If I was sober, I could read that and it would make sense. No, it wouldn't make sense. It's complete nonsense. It's stupid. Okay, here's something. This is, like, pretty, I guess. What?
We don't want pretty.
Oh, you don't want pretty.
We want the real thing.
Read us something, Brian.
Okay, I'm gonna go pretty, and then I'll do non-pretty later. Some say they remember the wound. I don't believe them, not because I think it is impossible, but because such a memory would be unutterable. Language would not support, could not describe that habitat. Even the warm, wounded word of the womb does not approach that prenatal world, an alien world that must come before civilization, before words. But we can hear the songs of humanity inside, feel the pangs of life against the walls. In this first room, our cities and valleys, our machines and spirits, our aches and joys echo around and tumble awkwardly outside, like ghosts scratching at a frosted window pane. We may think we are safe in our dark oasis of heaven, and we may claw at the walls for fear of ever leaving. And someday there... Oh, no. I don't know what I'm saying. And someday...
Yeah!
No, I totally fucked up. We may think we are safe in our dark oasis of heaven, and some may claw at the walls for fear of ever leaving, and some may die in their little bliss. We, though, have all been banished from that garden. Our birth is the great transition from utopia to this. Should I read one more thing?
Yeah!
I just totally embarrassed myself.
All of the above.
Yeah, I know, that's true. Okay, hold on a second.
Number five.
Okay. I apologize, I'm really unprepared. Gale and Benjamin Cloud had each other, shared a mother and father, and lived inside of a giant turtle. Both siblings were bright, though Benjamin stammered and had difficulty hearing, and Gale was a mischievous prankster with a penchant for leaping without looking. Their father was named Linden.
Linden,
yes, right, Linden, like Linden.
Very Linden.
Yeah, like you like yourself or something, but Linden.
But Linden.
Linden, yeah. It sounds sort of like Linden, but it's Linden.
Linden,
yeah, I think. Is that right? Yeah. Their father was named Linden, but they didn't call him that. They called him Pop. Linden. They called him Pop. Pop.
Linden.
Pop. Not Linden. Pop. And their mother, she was a Gretchen. Gail sometimes called her that because she thought the name was pretty, which it is. Gretchen. Pretty name. Both pretty names. But other ways, they call Gretchen Mom. Pop, Linden, Pop, enjoyed word games and had a variety of nicknames for both children. Mom, Gretchen. Mom's... Linden's dead. He's dead. Mom's dark humor sometimes flew toward melancholy, but she lightened her dismal thoughts with frequent song. As mentioned before, they all lived inside of a giant turtle. And this turtle's name was Peter, and he swam through the ocean to various lands with only his whim to guide him. Peter, the turtle. Peter could not talk, but the Cloud family knew how the turtle felt by looking at the walls. They changed color, you see, depending on Peter's mood. That's all I have.
So, I got three poems. The first one is a translation we did from Spanish to English. And this is going to be appearing on the Pyrenees Fountain online publication, the Spring Summer Edition. I will not bore you with the Spanish, so I'm going to leave it in English. But by Bernardo Leduc, he's the author. He was the son of a French father and a Mexican mother. He served as a signalist in Francisco Villa's División del Norte, studied law at the Universidad Nacional de Mexico. He wrote poetry, stories, and chronicles. He traveled to Paris, where he met several surrealistic writers. Leduc was a good friend of Elena Poniatowska, Federico Cantú, Luis Cardosa de Aragón, Octavio Paz, and Agustín Lara, as well as Maria Félix, to whom he was proudly married. The title of the poem is The Passing of the Years by Leduc. I'm not glad nor scared about the senile condition thing. I live quiet and comfortable during December and spring. Lady friends and chums give me the gift of their friendship, and yet I do not feel the outbreaks of my deadly disease. My effort and decorum I hide from strangers' eyes. They naturally decay, the passing years have run by. The natural decay, so many, many years cannot be healed with gold. It gets easier with guts. It all starts with eyebrows elongate while we lose our sight. Women don't give a damn, let alone a date. While your testicles lengthen and your penis shortens, the longing makes you sad, and the shyness fucks you up. In the northern mountains, a peasant pontificates, do not believe yourself or come up short. Don't even think walking into the drugstore. And then your teeth rotten and the skull looks bald. Oh, I hope my rope won't snap. This is my last hug. Then death comes. Sooner or later, it has to come. And since you are no longer strong, then hell with it. Sleep where you belong. Renato Lima. Okay, I live in North Seattle, and a couple Sundays ago I took a dog for a walk, and this is what I saw there. There's no title. Kind of like a work in progress. Sunday morning bathing Gath, Kumbh Mela, or the cross. Away from the daily detritus. Prosody, what they call ritual. Call, calling. Again and again a response. Raucous chorus chasing ducks across the pond. Noisy spectacle. Sui generis, black corvi dip their heads in the water, standing in at the shore, like pilgrims at the, by the Ganges, offering Ganga to Surya. The crows don't know anything spiritual, beyond their black feathers, blacker than the pupils of the beady eyes. And this one is, after reading the whole book, I just couldn't put it down. He's got many more. Marty Mass. Marty traveled Mexico City roads, moving backwards in time to find Coca-Cola and Singer sewing machines and pool tables. He called them the unholy trinity. Marty dedicated poems to all he knew. This goes to him. Hot, smoky boy immersed in pipe green smog on the outskirts of dusty roads, climbing hills dressed in yellow leaves with rattle, snake breath, and elephant dreams. The green cocoons become butterflies released by the seashore, where the shaman puts the jigsaw puzzle piece back in the black hole we call sky. The monsoons, leaving water to dampen the quickest spirit, bring down the highest mind, thunderbird lips etched on bones. Let those dreams swing, rioting hammocks, gardenia fragrance, too sweet for the tiger claws, alchemy of love, stitched on butterfly jaws. Hey, lady! Bring your ivory towers, plant your roots next to the copulating earthworms by the temple doors. Please unravel your cosmic eyes, let them cascade down your shoulders to your lovely hips. My pendulum grows and glows from heart to ear. Please ease my clock's inner frenzy. I'm hanging on the tips of my gay spines, where the skulls are pale, transfixed by the sunlight and the spinning mirrors. The rancid stench of putrid lives under the gray sky, Mexico's dirt and grime, unexplored madness. Only the stoplight clowns know where to find. Madness lurks and howls, cloying thoughts waiting for the green hummingbirds to break the purple dawn and taste the sugar mountains of the unknown along with the stones below. Thank you.
Greg.
No, Greg Love. My poem's called Death Rang the Bell 10 times. Death rang the bell 10 times. First time, blind Popeye came to the door, speaking. The second time, angels hailed the storm, as the door slid open. The third time a quiet gangster ghost by with premonitions. The fourth time open only a death creeping shadows on the lake dug my mind backwards. The fifth time Peter Pan shadows of the passage of time. Silence introduced herself painfully loud. The sixth time, coffin shavings in her wake. The seventh time, her slanted husband crept everywhere, sweeping with the child. The eighth time, who's blinded and old. The ninth time, death nightly walked till morning. Death rang the bell 10 times.
Yeah! Steve? I like that, Steve.
So, you know the Hugo House had their Born in the USA contest? This is one of the losers. Me, Born in the USA. All my calls begin with Amazon seller support. This is Steve. Can I please have the last 4 digits of your credit card or bank account? And about once a day, the response is, do you know English? Were you born here? Most of the callers I speak with have just spent 10 minutes on the phone with a customer service agent located in one of our international call centers. By the time they get to me, they've already spelled out their email address at least twice in military call letters. I give them a confident yup to the question, were you born here? Once the caller is confident that I'm one of their kind, I put them on hold and I tell them that I need to do some research, which means popping my head over my cubicle wall to ask the girl next to me the exact same question. 99% of the time she knows the answer, tells me, then I take the customer off hold and answer the question. The girl on the other side of my cubicle wall is Ambika, a shy woman with a nervous smile who dresses in sweaters from the young adult section at Macy's and has a thick Indian accent. When we went through training together in a class of over 20 people, we were the only two who honestly expressed our anxieties at the thought of not being able to answer a customer's question. She fought her anxiety by doing the best in training, making sure to learn everything, so there would never be an opportunity for a customer to get mad at her for not knowing the answer. I didn't follow the same approach. I spent most of training trading IMs with a cute chick, trying to make her LOL by sending her funny pictures of kittens. And reading Amazon one-star reviews of books written by authors I'm jealous of. Thankfully, Ambika was just a few inches of plywood away. On a regular basis, I got phone calls from someone asking, why can't I sell my breast pump in the used section? Or, how come no one is buying my used copy of the Da Vinci Code that's priced at $15? These are easy questions, which I can answer. Man, you can't sell used products in the health category. Plus, that's gross. And the reason no one's buying a used copy of the Da Vinci Code is because other people are selling it for one penny. You might want to consider lowering your price. The questions I feared were the ones about uploading giant inventory files or someone complaining about a privacy violation and how come they're not allowed to put their company address in their product picture. I never knew how to answer these questions. I'd put the customer on hold, pop my head over the cubicle wall. Hey, Amica, should a flat file be uploaded as XML or as an Excel spreadsheet? Or what is the policy on directing customers to an external website? Emeka always gave me an answer and never seemed bothered by it. Occasionally she would ask me something, but I was rarely helpful. Usually I would just smile and shake my head. We trained together and did the exact same job for the exact same amount of time. But she was much better at the job. That's not what I said. We trained together and did the exact same job for the exact same amount of time, but we had much different experiences. What I lacked in knowledge, I made up for with an easygoing voice and exceptional ability to not take anything personally. Being called stupid or an idiot is something you just have to get used to in the customer service game. Most people, when hiding behind ambiguity over the phone, are straight up rotten. But even with the worst of the worst, I could usually have them thinking I was their best buddy by the time we hung up. A few times a day, I would hear Amica say in her thick Indian accent, "No, sir, I'm in Seattle." One time she even followed up with, "Matt Hasselbeck." I can only imagine the customer she was speaking to asked, "If you're really in Seattle, who plays QB for the Seahawks?" One time a customer called her a bingy. I know this because I heard it shouted through the phone. When I leaned over to offer her support, she told me she was fine and not to worry about it. A few days later, she stopped coming in. Eventually, her cubicle was inhabited by a recent college graduate who had the way of, who pronounced the word zero like he was trying to shoot lasers out of his mouth. Amica's parents were not born in the USA, but she was. I was not. The customers calling and asking if I was born in the USA have a very limited view of what being born in the USA means, as if white people with TV sitcom accents are the only people born here. I've lived in 4 major American cities, so I'm familiar with the melting pot that is America, but I've never experienced it like I did in phone support. I average 25 calls a day from all over America and speak with every nationality. More often than not, I'm the one asking the customer to repeat themselves because I can't tell if they're saying C or Z. It really would be easier if we all just said Z. Every once in a while I'm told, you speak English really well. I'm not sure if I should be taking that as a compliment. I do know it's better than the one time a girl told me that I sounded like Napoleon Dynamite. I've lived here over 15 years and have yet to apply for citizenship. My green card expires in 6 years and have been eyeing the hips of one of my best female friends, wondering if the time comes, would she be willing to carry my anchor baby? She'll be 32 when my card expires, so if she hasn't already been knocked out by then, I might be her last shot before her eggs dry out. As an American educated male with the ability to exaggerate my skills in the workplace and my will to complete any assignment, no matter how boring or tedious, I can reassure her I will always have a job. I'm a professional temp. I move from temp job to temp job, stealing jobs from Americans while collecting unemployment in between gigs. We Canadians are always overlooked in the immigration debate. Mexicans are doing the jobs Americans don't want. Canadians are stealing the jobs Americans do want. Every time I hear an ignorant American yelling about Mexicans taking their jobs, I'm a little offended. Because as Canadians, as a people, I think we deserve to be recognized. In my 6 years living in Seattle, I've worked at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Amazon.com, Expedia.com, as well as countless short-term gigs where I've filed, shredded, and got important people coffee. I have a large collection of ID badges in the drawer next to my bed. They make good bookmarks. As a Canadian, I'd like credit for stealing some of those jobs. I came to the United States in 1993 with my family and my father's pursuit of the American dream. I then transferred him from Toronto to Connecticut so he could be the liaison between IBM America and IBM Latin America. My father is one of the smartest people I know. My father doesn't speak Spanish. It's ridiculous if you think about it. My father, a Canadian, was immigrated to America to be the liaison between IBM America and IBM Latin America. I'm happy my father got the job, and my father's a determined worker, and I wouldn't have had it any differently. But don't you think a Spanish-speaking Mexican might have been able to do a better job? My office is right next to the Lowe's hardware store. Every morning, the sidewalks are lined with eager men looking for work. When I drive past in my warm car, listening to talk radio, I consider picking one up. I'd split my hourly pay in half, and he can just hang out in my cubicle until an angry customer calls looking to bitch for no good reason. He can take those calls. The calls that not even a job-thieving Canadian doesn't want.
Thanks to everyone for sticking around. We have our final reader. Is it Caston? Is that how you say it?
Perfect.
Oh, good.
Give it up.
Taking the dinner first before I give it up. My name is Caston Griffin. This is my first time here. I'm excited to greet you guys. Hopefully I won't need this paper. Okay. This is called Sunflower. Remember when you wanted to name your cat Help, so that when you stuck your head out of the screen door at night and yelled, "Help! Help!" you'd know which of your neighbors really cared about you? That was funny. And I liked how for Arbor Day you bought me a sunflower tall for my sunset window, because you said the head reminded you of a round compass, and that little pink heart you drew on the westernmost petal pointed approximately back to you. That was one of my favorite daylight moments of ours. Before just a few rare hours, our connection was impressed between bedsheets, where, admittedly, we made love like poetic athletes, flinging the windows wide open so that even music teachers coming back from lovers' opera would think to themselves, "Now that is really something else." Or remember the morning your dog died and you asked me to describe you in two words, so I wrote Nicole Kidman on a wallet-sized piece of paper? Well, I lied. Honestly, you're more like a stapler, collecting ideals like gorgeous, intelligent, breathtakingly exquisite. And that thick volume of you, I'm sure, is heaven's prerequisite. Hell, I've got a plane ticket's worth of confessions to digress to, like, yes, I do like watching your old videos from childhood. Yes, it was me who planted the hollyhock outside by your mailbox because you once said life could use more hummingbirds. And yes, maybe I've spent weeks composing these petty words, rotating moments of you in lyrical stasis, thinking 90 billion trillion miles. That's how big space is. And I can't find a single metaphor to tell you just how pretty your face is. Which is just as well, because you are allergic to compliments and you're wary of drive-by relationships that leave you sideswiped. I know, believe me, I know I'm not really your type. And like the moon, I'm a lot less pretty close up. But when you come twirling across my yard, I try so hard not to tell you how beautiful you are, how beautiful you are, how beautiful you are, as many times as I think it. But the next time I call, maybe, I'll tell you that loving you is like stealing honey in a bear suit in the middle of summer. Except maybe I am you. And instead of a bear suit, it's nothing at all. Maybe the honey is my boxer shorts. And instead of summer, it's midnight, you're fast asleep and singing, "How sweet it is to be loved by you," in your dreams with the moon tangled in your ponytail. But I'll probably just get your voicemail and say, "Hey, I know you're used to small talk and horseplay, but I'm tired of feeling lost and found, so call me. If you want a room full of flowers, call me if you miss my toes in your shower. Just call me if you want me around." Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, thanks again. Be safe. Have a good night.